Come on and join me on the B-side. When movie stars that weren't in their prime made other movies that got left behind, that got them covered on the B-side. You're gonna like it on the B-side, 'cause you got Dan and Connor by your side, throwing your knowledge from the inside. And now you're listening to the B-side.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the B-side for the film stage. Here, we talk about movie stars and filmmakers, and not the movies that made them famous or kept them famous, but the ones that they made in between. And today, we have a fun conversation for you. Dan sits down to speak with Nancy Savoca, the great filmmaker whose second feature, Dogfight, is now currently available via the Criterion Collection. There are a bunch of great supplements along with it, including a new restoration and a brand new commentary. Also, some interviews with Savoca and Lily Taylor, conducted by filmmaker Mary Herron, and a great essay by critic Christina Newland, among other things. So Dan got to chat with Nancy about missing movies, her mentors like John Sayles and Maggie Renzi, her first film, True Love, the creativity boom of the mid to late 90s on HBO, including things like Carl Franklin's Laurel Avenue, which we've talked about on this show, and Savoca's own If These Walls Could Talk. She also spot checks lesser seen gems, including Dirt from the early 2000s and the recently restored and released Household Saints from 1993. So without further ado, here's our conversation with Dogfight director Nancy Savoca.
Okay, so let's just jump into it. So it's an honor to talk to you, and it's so cool. So it's just starting out, like, and you can maybe just, I know you've answered this question a bunch of times, but Dogfight, obviously, through Criterion, is kind of finally out again after, you know, coming out initially in 1991.
And very briefly, if you blinked, you would have missed it.
All right. So I guess it was a long process, obviously, and I was lucky enough, actually, at an event that this past Sundance, I talked to Ira Deutschman a little bit about just the larger scope of, like, all of this recovery and rights detective. John Sayles came on this podcast a couple months ago, as a matter of fact, and where we were kind of talking to him about, like, him and Maggie Renzi, and, like, City of Hope just came out, right? And what, from your first-person point of view, is that just like a Sherlock Holmes novel of...
You are hitting on my favorite subject these days, so thank you for bringing it up. First thing up, first of all, John and Maggie are my mentors, so right. I adore them. Ira Deutschman is also a very important person in my life because he greenlit the third film we did, Household Saints, and I am working with Ira now, and my husband Rich, and Mary Herron, and Dennis Doris, Amy Heller, as well as Sue Bodine and Jeffrey Fletcher. We are on the board of a group called Missing Movies, and it's a not-for-profit to educate film fans about the fact that you're not dreaming. It's actually true that your movies are not available to you.
Nice.
Yeah.
And so I guess, you know, obviously correct me here, but like from a large scale, right? So much of it has, like, the first thing I think of, not to get away from Dogfight, we'll bring it back, but, like, I always think of Pump Up the Volume, because I remember the thing with that movie was, like, the music, right? It was always like, it's all about the music. And so when they made the movie, you know, whenever they made that movie, 1990, whatever it was, you know, those music rights go to, like, 91, right? Because, you know, at that time, there is VHS, whatever, but it's still this secondary market scenario. The music rights are different. And then it all changes, right? Everything becomes streaming, whatever happens. And so now somebody wants to put out, you know, this cult movie, Pump Up the Volume, they want to put it out. And they're like, wait, but we don't have the rights to any of the, you know, the identity of the movie, you know.
You're hitting on something. It is one of the many problems that exist. And that's the problem with this problem, is that it's like got tentacles like you wouldn't believe. Right. It could be that the people who were, unbeknownst to the director, perhaps, the people who were either distributing the film or producing the film, figured out that the best way they could deal with their budget was to pay for the smallest amount of rights, which means the window was really tiny.
Yeah.
Or the because what we are telling everybody now is get those rights forever in perpetuity in all known universes, et cetera, until the end of time, because yeah. that's how you an audience will still be able to watch a film. But that is only one of the things that can go wrong. We with Household Saints, we actually the music rights were not an issue. With Household Saints, it was that we thought we had prints of the film. They were damaged. We couldn't find the elements to the picture. And then to complicate that, the rights were a question. Who owned the film?
Like so the actual film
rights. The actual film rights. Another problem you can have is that you actually know that a company owns the film rights. And they just don't want to do anything with your film. So it's sitting in a shelf somewhere. That's when we call it the hostage situation. So yeah. It really is such a complex problem. And like it could be any number of things that have gone wrong. But what we know for sure is that a lot of the films, particularly in the 90s, because it's sort of like the recent sort of wave of lots of films getting made,
yeah.
are in trouble because at that time, movies were being made very, very quickly to become content for home video. So often the distributors weren't necessarily the people that were raising the money. They were like, they would cobble together different entities to make a film. And of that cobbling together, all kinds of things were promised and didn't happen or happened or got lost.
Well, and I'll get back to that because that's a Household Saints thing. But I was digging into all the elements of the new, there's a beautiful, as part of the Dogfight Criterion, set.
An amazing job. They did an
Yeah, like job. A great essay by Christina Newland, which was lovely. And then there's some interview, Mary Harron, I think, interviews. Is it you? Who does Mary Harron interview? You and
me and Lily. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. Right.
And so it's like such a good interviewer.
Right. Yeah. No. And, Mary Harron herself, who obviously is somebody who I couldn't speak to the rights of all of her movies or whatever, but
I Shot Andy Warhol is one of the films that were,
that doesn't surprise me.
Yeah.
Right, yeah, and of course that's an iconic movie, very much in the vein of kind of what we're talking about is 90s, and you had these kind of, all these different, like the movie I remember with, I don't know if we mentioned this to John Sayles, but I was talking to somebody about it, one that like, I think you can only, it's on YouTube, is like Men with Guns, right?
Wow, yep.
Great movie, right? Great. Late 90s, great but movie. It's like, just like, I don't know, I think they're trying to figure it out. Anyway, so Dogfight, rewatching it right before we jumped on, and it's funny because I put the commentary on, which is part of the Criterion disc. What's interesting is you mentioned this in the film because I feel like you said Lily mentioned this when you were filming, and I love movies that do this. You make a movie that has an ending in the first act and then keeps going, right? Like, and I was thinking about how Household Saints kind of does that too.
Yeah,
and I wonder if I wonder how much you've investigated that in your own career. Is that are you drawn to kind of the I guess the subverting of expectations that comes with that? I mean, obviously you could point to classical story. There it does exist, obviously, but like it is like a little even rewatching it. You're like, oh yeah, like she confronts him. And then they go on a date, and Household Saints, there's some of that too. And even I was like rewatching If These Walls Could Talk. Demi Moore is like already pregnant, you know, so even that movie, it's kind of like
we come in at a weird time.
Things have been happening and we're like, oh, okay, here we go. So I don't know anything.
Yeah. It's funny. I think we were talking about music rights before, but I think about music because I think I love pop music so much, and I love how it really satisfies all my expectations. But I love, although I'm mostly ignorant about jazz, I love jazz maybe more because I never know where it's going. And the next note is never the note I expect to happen. And I think there's a part of me that really enjoys stories that do that to me. I don't really know where it's going. I also grew up in the 70s, so those films of the anti-heroes and the just kind of everybody was experimenting late 60s, early 70s with these experimenting with like the narrative form. So I think I don't think I sort of sit down to say I'm going to do that, but I think like that's you're influenced by that. Mm-hmm. So I really enjoy being surprised. I also enjoy going to where the story says we have to go and not necessarily where formula tells you where to go. So that's really, or where characters actually, because when story tells you where to go, that might be more dramatic, like drama, like plot driven melodrama or something. But when it's character driven, that's like its own thing, because then you're really not at the mercy of the story at all. Like the characters are telling you where to go, what to do.
Well, and it's funny too, I come from an Italian family and the Household Saints thing is so relatable, because it is, you do the thing in that movie of like, this is just a story that's like, it's been being told for a long time. And it's like coming from a family like that, you know, not exactly like that, but you know, my family's from Portchester, so it's a similar tri-state area, whatever. And like, it's totally like that, you know, like you, there's just a story that your grandpa told you, your cousin knows, your aunt actually knew it. And then it's like, I'll tell
and
my
And then they argue,
that.
Yeah, but how exactly it went, because now everybody's remembering it a little different. Yeah, and also,
you know, and then like people pass away, and maybe you find out the truer version of, or like, oh, he was in the war, but he actually was over there, like stuff that you just kind of, people didn't talk about or whatever it is. You
know? Yeah, no, these are oral histories and oral stories that might have a bit of fiction, a bit of poetry in them. You know, just because sometimes the poetry gets us a little closer to the feeling of the truth, you know, or something. But yeah, I really enjoy that. My mom was a great storyteller. My dad became a great storyteller after my mom passed away. It was interesting. Like he had to take over for her. But she was an excellent, excellent storyteller. Yeah.
That's interesting. Yeah, I mean, it comes through in the films, of course. And I think it's interesting how, yeah, like you're saying, the characters, I suppose they do kind of dictate where it goes. I have to ask, because I brought up John Sayles, and I was just kind of looking into it. You got to tell me one thing about being on the set of Brother from Another Planet, because and this is going to be really inside baseball, but that's okay for all. Yeah,
I don't understand baseball, so please.
This is very film set specific, but I think most of our listeners kind of know that by now. Were you just stealing all those locations? Like, because that movie is just like on the streets, and it's like, do you remember, like what was that?
You know,
like,
I wouldn't be able to speak for Maggie Renzi because she was the producer. So I don't know. I'm assuming that, you know, there was a lot of equipment. I don't think we could steal a lot of it, but I don't know. I don't know what they did on the fly, because I think that's the thing about working in New York is that you have your permits, you got to park your trucks, you got to things legit. And then once in a while you see something, and if you're lucky enough to grab it, you grab it.
Of course, I think. It just, that movie
it
feels
was very much, that movie.
It feels so discovered, right? You're like, what is this thing? So that was your first film.
I was a production assistant on it. I worked in the office.
I love it.
I was, So it was.
Man, so production assistant from there to then True Love in the late 80s, what was that evolution? I mean, how does that,
but
I mean,
about, what is that, 6 years in there?
I was going to say, that's not, ultimately not that long.
Yeah. So Brother from Another Planet was right out of film school. I had just graduated from NYU and saw an ad by the elevator of the production building. After I did that gig, then you sort of get to know people, and I was invited to work on Almost You, which was Adam Brooks's film, and then I'm going to go through my bio, which I'm not going to remember anything about. I basically worked on New York was just hopping at the independent films at that point, so it was a really interesting time. It was kind of a beautiful time. People really knew each other. And I went in a lot of like assistant work. Then I ended up, I was an assistant editor for the man who became my editor on True Love. I assisted him first. And then we did a little promo film for True Love to raise some money. Right. And during the day, I was his assistant. And then at night, after hours from our job, he became my editor and I was his director. So it was really, it was a lot of collaboration and a lot of, I think, very important contributions that everybody was making.
Yeah, and it's amazing how like we're talking about, so many of those people are still working and making stuff. Adam Brooks, obviously, still.
Yeah.
You know, he made, I think, kind of an underrated, it's a studio movie, but an underrated New York movie, definitely, maybe, that Ryan Reynolds movie. That's a lovely kind of early year studio release that's deeply New York. So Dogfight, there's so much to just, I have notes here. So I loved.
You know what? Let me because I know you asked me a question, and maybe this is helpful to you. So going from Brother from Another Planet to True Love, working on all these different films, and then at one point we did do this. We couldn't get money, couldn't get anybody to invest in True Love, and so we did a little promotional piece, and then we screened that for everyone we had ever worked for, because we were working in the independent film world. Rich was doing accounting and I was doing assisting. And what came of that was we still got universally rejected by production companies for financing, but we got the support of filmmakers. John Sayles became one of our investors. Susan Saddleman became one of our investors. Oh. Kenny Yutt became one of our investors, our producer Kenny Yutt. Jonathan Demme became one of our investors. And their contributions was enough so that we can then go out to everybody's, like, dentist, doctor, lawyer, who wanted to invest in film. And all that money was raised independently. But it was started by the community that was in New York, basically. So we were super, super grateful to that. And that's how True Love got made.
Yeah. I mean, that's so organic and, like, so, I feel like, emblematic. Yeah.
Well, if you think about it, we had no known actors. Every single actor, with the exception of Annabella Sciorra, who had done a television movie with Sophia Loren. With the exception of Annabella, every one of those actors had never been on film before. So we were working, just with brand new people. So the financing was tough for that reason.
Yeah, and at awards at the United States Film Festival, which was Sundance, which is so funny. What I love is, so, this is, I feel like, an unanswerable question, but just as a filmmaker, I'm just always curious. With someone like Lily Taylor, is it? And I know you've mentioned how important casting was, and how crucial, and of course that's such an important thing. But I don't even understand, like, actresses at performers like her, I don't even understand how they do what they do. Like, you watch her in something like Dogfight. And then just anything she's done since, right? Where, like, she's covered every manner of emotional whatever, like, and, you know, Household Saints, God knows. Like, as a director, are you just kind of trying to, like, harness this thing that she had, right? Like, I wonder how much molding even is there, I suppose, like, once she's kind of going, you know? And I guess River Phoenix to a similar degree. I mean, obviously, you know, but. It's so lightning in a bottle, those two lead performances in Dogfight.
They are. And I think, you know, if I have a, what my place is, I feel, in all of these, is to communicate to the actors the journey that I think the story is taking me on, is taking us on. And so everyone can join the same trip, so that we're not acting in different movies. So I give as much information as I can. Every kind of actor will take that information differently. Some people want to sort of go off with this information and do their thing. And if that's the way they work, that's the way that, you know, I respect that. Some people really collaborate quite deeply. And that's very exciting for me, because I'm not an actress, but I have, like, acting background for training, for whatever reason. I picked that up along the way. So I think whatever the actor needs is what I try to give them. But the basic thing that has to happen for me is that they understand where I want to go with the story, because my job is to look at the story and figure out what it wants to be. Having said that, you know, it's almost like saying, here, that script is like a song, right? And I'm an interpreter of that song. So you can give that same script to, like, 10 different directors and you get 10 different, you know, movies, like you would get 10 different songs if you have a country singer or a hip hop singer, you know, a Cuban singer, and, you know, like you would get the same music done quite differently. So we bring our flavor to it. But for me, as I try to share with the actors as much so that once they get, you know, lit up on that, then really it's just about us all headed together in the same place. I don't know that there's anything, I don't know that I'm telling them what to do beyond that, except that early stuff is just information so that they can, then they end up taking that character and go to places that I couldn't imagine.
Right. Yeah. And I think, I mean, do you find, you know, as you kept directing, you know, TV and film through the years, how did the process change in the director's chair? Like, what did it, did you find yourself becoming more efficient? Or I guess what would be a good way to describe the learning process? Because I'm always curious with, like, directors.
When you start doing it, if you do it often, then you start realizing that there's actually, you know, a method to the madness. You can articulate certain things. I found that I got very good at saying, oh, these are scenes we don't need. So I got very good at actually editing scripts as we go along, so we don't spend time and money shooting stuff you don't need. Like, oh, we already said this. So I think it's like being on high alert while you're shooting to say, and what are we accomplishing so far? And boy, do we already have this? And not just yourself as a director, but to be open to hearing that perhaps from a very good creative producer, which I have in my partner, Rich, because he's also a screenwriter, so he thinks story. And we'll argue it sometimes, and sometimes we'll disagree and, you know, whatever. But it's really good to hear people who understand what you're trying to do, hear from them, you know, what their opinions are. Everyone, really, your entire creative team. So there's that, the articulating of, like, the story comes a little faster when you've done a lot. And for me, the also finding out, you know, the big differences between being a film director and being a television director, very, very, very different.
Right.
Roles. For a film director, you are the storyteller. You carry the story, and you're making all those decisions, and it's just you. When you're if you're working on a series and there's several directors, your job is basically to listen to the show creators. They carry the story and make sure that you are there to help that story move on to the next, till the next episode. Really,
it's, you know, and to some degree, it's fascinating. You've been kind of at the forefront of these little movements, right? Like, you know, 1989 was a huge year at Sundance, obviously, with Soderbergh and Michael Moore, I think, and then the HBO boom of the kind of mid 90s, like we talked to Carl Franklin last year, and he had Laurel, I think it's Laurel Avenue, right? Which we were talking to him about, which was a huge moment at HBO. And that was, I think, only a few years before If These Walls Could Talk. And like, that must have been interesting to be a part of. Like, that was in its own way, this like little boom of creativity.
Yeah,
right?
HBO was doing some really interesting work. I think they were pushing the envelope on a lot of things. It was a very exciting place story-wise. They were very interested, I think, in because they already had their subscribers. It was such an interesting way to look at things, which I really appreciated. They had their subscribers, so they weren't, like, you know, racing for the ratings. They were just trying to do what they consider the top quality, just quality challenging things. And, you know, it was a great opportunity for us, the filmmakers who were involved with them.
Yeah, when you go back and you look, it really feels like this, not like a hidden gem, because you can watch these things. Well, even though Laurel Avenue,
we hope you can watch these.
I was going to say, we were talking to Carl about that, you kind of can't watch Laurel Avenue. It's kind of wild, but you can watch, you can currently watch If These Walls Could Talk. But like, to go back and try to discover those things, it almost feels underappreciated now, where you're kind of like, there was a golden ageness to that, of just doing, really tackling issues on a small screen, but with a presumably to some sort of a budget, and, you know, movie stars, you know, Demi Moore, Cher, you know, like these people.
Well, what's really interesting, I'm sorry that we're going back to missing movies, and I think we need to have a missing television, right? Because that's actually part of, like, when you say hidden gem, or do we know that we have this? That's a question. Do we know that we have this? Those of us who saw it, those of us who are old enough to have seen it, but I don't know that people that were not around for that time, unless you find a way to catch this stuff, some of this is really held tightly and is not available. It's just not available to be seen. Walls only came back, my understanding was because Cher really pushed for it.
Is that right? Yeah.
Mm-hmm, because we were gone for years, and the whole nightmare of the legal situation right now with abortion just growing and growing more and more restrictive. I was asking, like, where is Walls in this? Like, you know, I hate to say that it's way more, even more relevant now, or as relevant
sure.
now.
Yeah.
And it wasn't being seen. It wasn't it was not brought back. And then suddenly it appeared. And my understanding is that that was Cher.
Wow. Well, so that's, well, so there you go.
Like, I mean, pushing.
And it shouldn't have to be that, right? To your point of missing a movie, right? Like, it shouldn't have to be a superstar being like, I love this thing I was a creative force on. Like, let's make sure, you know. Yeah. Or like, I remember, like, this is such a tangent, but it's just like Barbara Streisand in her book talking about how, like, she had copies of The Way We Were, but like missing 10 minutes that like Sidney Pollack like was forced to cut out of the initial cut. And so it was just her who like had the film reels in her, you know, basement, who like had Tom Rothman add them back in for the 40th year release. And it's like, that's great. I mean, amazing way to go, Babs, but also like, it shouldn't have to be that, right? And obviously not every movie or TV show is going to have that person, of course, you know. It's
yeah.
Like, you know,
and what about those wonderful shows that we're all missing on, out on, that just don't have enough of a push, or people just, you know, are saying no? It's complicated because, you know, I've heard arguments, well, you know, you can't bring back every movie ever made. I'm like, you know what? We can try.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, it's worth trying.
Just do it. If you've got a favorite, if you're pushing there and someone else is pushing for their favorite, just making this available. Yes, we won't have them all available, but I can tell you one thing that's happening now that concerns me is that, well, as a film fan, super selfish, I have my movies I want to see and I can't find them. I don't have access to them.
Sure.
I have my movies that when I'm working on a project, I want to be inspired by them and I can't access them. Yeah. And I think even more important, I teach younger students, younger filmmakers, and I see their projects and I'm like, oh my gosh, you got to see this movie, this movie, this movie. And it's not available for them.
Right.
And that's a mistake. That is like, that's our future, man.
Yeah. And it's also just like, it's also to your point, just the attempt can lead to recently there was this push, there's this kind of lovely documentary about Alice Guy Blaché from the way early 1900s, like Jodie Foster narrated and helped kind of made. And I think that resulted in some restoration of her shorter films. And like, I didn't know, I mean, I'm pretty into like move, you know, you could, you know, I started a website, everything, you know, I work in the industry to support whatever. Right.
Yeah.
I'm like, who is this person? I watch this.
Absolutely.
And you go down this rabbit hole of like, not, and it's also like, not even like being like giving political platitudes of like, whatever, like I watch the movies. They're incredible movies, like truly great, great movies. Like, and you know, they're 10 minutes long. Some of them, God knows back in the 1900s, they are incredible. And now you can get box sets with, you know, as restorative as they can be, you know, given whatever shape they're in when they're found. But to your point, it's like, just even trying to do that leads to even a few of them
don't not try. If you've got something you love, don't not try. Get out there. We have a Letterboxd channel.
Yes.
We have the beginnings of a list. The beginnings of a list, because of course the list is very long. Add, subtract, you know, if the movies come out already and you've heard that and we haven't, add the movies that are missing from being on that list. And for me, the most important thing, another thing to remember is, listen, I was a young girl in film school. I was the only girl in my class when I was there in 1980. And I just remember, and newly married, so it was really crazy. I was like 20 years old. And I just remember, you know, I didn't see any, there weren't women filmmakers being taught to me. I saw them kind of on the outside. I saw like Claudia Wells' movie. I knew Agnes Varda a little bit. Why? Because I was kind of, you know, going, I had movie theaters outside my film school.
Right.
So I'm really concerned about today, where you don't have as many movie theaters outside of your film school. And then the first thing that happens when these movies go missing is that the people at the margins go fall first. So, you know, how many in the future are you going to look around and say, oh, did women make movies? You know, did people of color make movies? LGBTQ, who made movies? Oh, it pretty much looks like these guys made movies.
Right, these guys.
Yeah. It's so important, like just to know that for filmmakers in the future that they, people like them also were making films.
Yeah.
Since the beginning of film history, they were making
films. So true. Yeah. I mean, it's so crucially important. I think I feel like I'm coming to the end of my time. I wanted to ask you, just because we do cover every manner of movie, is there anything you've made, TV, film, anything that you would urge people to discover? Obviously, Dogfight Now has a platform, which is great. Household Saints.
So happy. I'm so happy.
Is there anything else where you're like, oh, try to find this, or I made an episode of this?
Well, I have to say, I mean, I have more missing movies, and there's a movie I did, a bilingual movie called Dirt, that we shot in New York and El Salvador, which is a comedy about immigration, because, you know, if you don't cry about immigration, you gotta laugh about it. And that movie was a Showtime film, and we're really working hard to try and get it back out there.
I was going to add it. That was one that I didn't know anything about, honestly.
No, and it won awards, you know, and all that. And the actress won awards, Julieta Ortiz. And I'm very, very proud of that movie. And I'm so glad that it exists. And I want to get it out in front of audiences so they can enjoy it too. So certainly that one. But honestly, you know, support all your missing movies. Find them any way you can and yell at people till they come back.
Yeah, I mean, I found myself, for this podcast, living at the library, you know, and like, you can still just, you know, discover a lot, you know, if you have, like a place like Pittsburgh or sort of New York, like there is a good system.
A good system.
But even God knows, it's like.
Get a DVD player again, just like you got your turntable back for your vinyl. Get a DVD player again. This is, there's treasures out there to inspire you. There really are.
That's well said. Well, Nancy, thanks for taking the time. Congratulations on it's a nice start to 2024 with all these.
Oh, really?
I was watching these interviews. You've been able to go out there and kind of talk about Dogfight and these, you know, and Household Saints. And just, I hope it spurns, like we're talking about, like, you know, with the City of Hope with sales. And I hope it spurns like Dirt and.
Yeah. Thank you.
Right. So anyway, good luck.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I appreciate it. Thank you for your time. Thanks, Dan.
Thanks again for listening, folks. If you like what you've heard, please do rate, review, and subscribe. It helps us out a great deal. You can follow us on social at TFS B-Side. In terms of what's coming up, we have an episode in the can on the B-Sides of Martin Scorsese, as well as an episode dropping in a few weeks on the B-Sides of Bruce Willis. And while you wait for those, you can be sure to check out our episode with Blake Howard from One Heat Minute Productions on the B-Sides of Robert Redford. Until then, thanks for listening. And now you're listening to the B-Side.